everyone, and welcome to episode 39 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sapolsky, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. As someone who's been working in and with medieval history for a while now, I've discovered that there's one topic that always gets people's attention: the Crusades. The word crusade automatically conjures up images of Templars and deserts, Richard the Lionheart, Saladin, and the walls of Jerusalem. It's a word that seems to imply polarity and tends to be dredged up to reinforce imagined ideas of polarity in the modern world. But the truth is that the Crusades were multifaceted, nebulous, and often confused. And they were full of crusaders, human beings with complex motivations of their own. If you've browsed the history section of any major bookstore in the last decade, or if you've turned on Netflix to look into the secrets of great British castles, you've come across the work of my guest this week, Dan Jones. Dan is the author of several best-selling books, including The Plantagenets, The Hollow Crown, and most recently, The Templars, The Rise and Spectacular Fall of God's Holy Warriors. This year, Dan's come out with a new book called Crusaders, an epic history of the wars for the Holy Lands. I caught up with Dan to talk about the new book, George R.R. Martin, and why it's important for historians to be writing and talking about the Crusades today. Thanks, Dan, for joining me. It's great to have you on the podcast. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
I think that something that people don't know is that you were actually my first interview ever in 2015. We were talking Magna Carta, and I was like totally intimidated, but you were lovely, and now we're friends, so hooray.
Yeah, I can actually remember very like clearly that interview, because I was sitting in a hotel room in Washington, D.C., and I can remember actually the wire on the phone was like quite tangly, and I've got a very, very clear sense of memory of doing that interview. So I guess like it boded well for the future in some way.
You're still talking to me.
Stuck with me anyway. It's like, yeah, I'm still talking to you. Come on.
So it can't have been that bad. So you've just come out with Crusaders, which has just come out in the United States, October 1st, I think it was. And in this book, you talk about all the Crusades, as much crusading as someone could possibly fit into one book. But why did you call it Crusaders instead of Crusades?
Because I think that R is really important, that second R in the word, because it speaks to like the approach I wanted to take with Crusaders, which was not to add to this gigantic pile of crusade surveys, you know, the Chris Tyman, Jonathan Phillips, Tom Asbridge books of recent years, all going back to the 50s to Stephen Runciman, the great 3-volume history of the Crusades, in between those, Jonathan Riley Smith. Yeah. I didn't want to write another one of those big surveys because, like, that's been done, and I wanted a sort of a different approach and different challenge in a way. And so Crusaders speaks to the way the book's structured, which is in 3 main parts, each of 9 chapters. And those chapters are what in fiction you would call viewpoint chapters. So each one takes a character or set of characters on occasion, small set of characters, but normally one character, and uses them as a vehicle to see a particular slice of crusading history. And so the book progresses like with these people speaking to each other in a way, you know, because, you finish the first chapter and you leave that viewpoint and go to a different person's viewpoint. And what that allowed me to do was to cast a really wide variety of characters from the 400 years of crusading that I'm discussing, you know, between the end of the 11th century and end of the 15th century. Because I felt quite strongly that the important thing in writing about crusades now, more than ever, is, well, I'm slightly allergic to this word, but let's use it, is diversity. It's having a sense of the huge range of places and peoples who were affected by and took part in crusading, you know, so not just the Christians of the Latin West, the sort of Richard Lionheart types, but also, you know, Greek Christians, Syrian Christians, Armenian Christians, Arabs, Turks, Kurds, Sunni and Shia Muslims, Jewish people, men, women, children, you know, a wide, wide range. I mean, it's a very pluralistic approach to crusading. And in order to give that some order, some shape, and let's be frank here, some readability, I decided to use characters as a sort of deep dive into each progressive period of crusading. And it was an idea that I first had sort of seriously used in the first chapter of Templars, which was the last medieval history book I wrote, where in that first chapter where you sit with Ceolwulf, the British pilgrim who comes off the ship at Jaffa in 1102-3, And I used Ceolwulf's journey around the Holy Land as a pilgrim right after the First Crusade. And I used his eyes and his diary as a way of showing the reader what the Crusader kingdom looked like, rather than telling. You know, so many books about crusading begin with, you know, a sort of a clearing of the throat, and I, the great historian, will now survey the world of the late 11th century. Like, and there are many great historians who've done great work, but it's hard going, particularly for, you know, non-specialist readers. And so, well, you know how I like to write. This seemed like an approach that would suit me better.
Yeah, and I was speaking to Natalie Zeman Davis last week about this, and she was doing the same thing. We were talking about how she takes individual stories when she's telling her histories, because that's a good way to integrate all the stuff that's going on around them, but also make you kind of feel something that you wouldn't necessarily feel if it was just kind of dry dates and history. So you picked a whole bunch of characters, like you say, from a diverse range, writing from the Islamic perspective as well as the Christian perspective. So who are some of the people that you liked pulling out to speak for us?
Who are some of my favorite characters? Weirdly, like the start of the book, I wrestled with how to start the book, because the obvious place and the obvious character is to take Urban II, right, in Clermont 1095, and just do the sort of urban speech. But that then immediately puts you into a very sort of great white man mode, in which the Crusades are sort of seem to emanate from a great man giving a great speech. And that's kind of like, A, old hat, and B, not correct. Like, or not the only story, you know. I wanted to find ways that I could weave in the different threads of stuff that was going on in the Mediterranean world in the, you know, the 1060s, 70s, 80s. So the first character that I started the book with was Roger, Count of Sicily. And I tell the story of Roger in Sicily as it's told by Ibn al-Athir, you know, the great Iraqi chronicler of the 13th century. So the first line of the book, which is sort of the punchline of Ibn al-Athir's anecdote about Roger, is Roger, Count of Sicily, lifted his leg and farted. Because Ibn al-Athir sort of implies that the whole of the Crusades begin with Roger dismissing some ambassadors from one of his cousins who want to use Sicily to attack Muslims in North Africa by just sort of farting in their general direction, a la the Frenchman in Monty Python,
yeah,
and the Holy Grail. And it just seemed to me, A, to be a comical first line in a book about crusading, to include a sort of an agreeable amount of bathos, in that, you know, this whole big subject is often taken in a very po-faced, serious way, could be turned on its head and could begin in, you know, that you could take the butterfly effect of a fashion, but instead of a butterfly flapping its wings, a sort of a Norman man in Sicily lets out a great sort of guff of flatulence, and out of it comes 400 years of warfare. For me, that was an amusing and attractive proposition. But it has a sort of serious historical purpose as well, which is to say that once you start in this odd place, you're forced to think about, well, hey, why is Sicily important? Because, you know, if you don't understand Sicily, you never get a proper handle on crusading in general. Sicily comes back and back and back and back and back all the way through, and it's absolutely crucial to understand it. So Roger's a great sort of favourite of mine, because he lets the story erupt, as it were, from a very unexpected place.
And I know you were speaking to Helen Castor, I think it was for BBC, about Margaret of Beverley being one of your favourites as well. She's a great character. She's
awesome. I was working my way up to Margaret of Beverley. Margaret of Beverley is my number one favourite. She's my girl, right? So Margaret's story, if you want me to recap, this is Third Crusade era, so we're fast-forwarding a long way. So this is post-Battle of Hattin, 4th of July, 1187. Crusader army led by King Guy, crushed on the battlefield by Saladin, the great Kurdish general risen to become Sultan of Syria and Egypt, was in the process of unpicking the Crusader kingdom. Then in October 1187, takes the city of Jerusalem. Margaret of Beverley is a Yorkshire lass, you know, she's from northern England, as her name implies. And she'd been born in Jerusalem, where her parents were there on pilgrimage. Then she'd gone home to England and grown up there. Her parents had died, and she'd raised a younger brother called Thomas. You know, she'd packed him off to a Cistercian monastery to become a monk. Then she'd gone on what we call a gap year in England. So she'd gone back to Jerusalem, right? But she winds up there in 1187 while the Ayyubid army, Saladin's army, is outside the walls besieging it. And so according to the account of her life, she's up on the walls, like hurling stones at these guys with a slingshot, wearing a cooking pot saucepan on her head because there's no helmet, not enough helmets to go around. She's badly injured when a trebuchet shoots a gigantic stone, the size of a millstone, at the walls of Jerusalem. It shatters. She's hit by shrapnel, but she survives. And she survives when Balian of Ibelin negotiates a peace with Saladin. There's no massacre a la 1099 in Jerusalem. There's a sort of orderly handover of power. Margaret leaves the city, but then she's kidnapped and enslaved 15 months. She's 15 months of hard labor, you know, beaten with sticks if she doesn't do what she's told. She says, I wept so much that my tears rusted my chains. She eventually is freed. But at the time that she's freed, Richard the Lionheart and Philip Augustus have arrived, besieged Acre, and are now have turned basically the Kingdom of Jerusalem into a war zone. So she's forced to wander around this Third Crusade war zone, begging in rags. Now, while she's doing this wandering, of course, Richard and Saladin are kind of sending each other ice and fruit and chivalric messages. Mm-hmm. And Richard's kind of slaughtering hostages on the plain outside Acre. They're marching down the coast, and he's having these running battles with Saladin's army, and then he's heading to Jerusalem and being beaten back, and then fighting in Jaffa and going to Jerusalem and giving up, and everyone's sort of going, oh, let's go home. And all the while, Margaret's wandering around begging. Now, eventually she survives, and when the Third Crusaders go home, she goes home, and she manages to track down her brother Thomas when she gets back to the West. And then she meets him in the monastery, and they write down her story. This is a beautiful story in its own right. It's a great way into the Third Crusade from, if we consider the Third Crusade to be the most, like, quote-unquote, dick-waving of all the Crusades. Like the ultimate macho sort of crusade, the one that's always in, the films, Robin Hood and Kingdom of Heaven and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. I was just so thrilled to come across a character who I could deploy to stand our whole way of thinking about the Third Crusade on its head. Because, I used Margaret. I brought in Joanna of Sicily, Richard's sister, who's there for a lot of the crusade. And this negotiation, whether she's going to marry Saladin's brother, is part of the peacemaking deal. She doesn't in the end. And then you bring Berengaria. So I sort of elevated all the women in the Third Crusade to, like, best actress, right? And all the men to best supporting actor category. Mm-hmm. And that was incredibly satisfying to do. And, of course it felt germane to write, to stand this history on its head when writing a book to be published in 2019. It's also the driving kind of philosophy of Crusaders is think again, look at these stories, these events, these sort of moments in crusading from a different perspective, and you will see new things about them. So for me, Margaret was my favorite character because she really, more than any other crusader in the book, captured what that was all about.
Yeah, and I like that because I think that people will see Crusaders on the front of the book and they'll think this is going to be about the Third Crusade. It's going to be about Richard. It's going to be about Saladin. That's what it's going to be about. And you really don't spend a huge amount of time on those two people. And you don't spend a huge amount of time on the Third Crusade. You kind of put it in perspective as this is a whole range of things happening over 400 years. And it doesn't all happen in the Holy Land either. So you talked about other crusades against the people in the Baltics. You talked about Cathar crusades. You talked about Mongols and Mamluks and stuff like that. So why did you take such a big picture approach to crusades? Why don't you just stick with the Third Crusade like everybody else, Dan?
Oh, man. Why have I let you all down? because that's just not crusade. Like, to understand crusading, it just struck me as so impossible to do that with a focus that's entirely narrow and focused and directed exclusively towards Greater Syria and Palestine, as it was then, the Holy Land in the Middle East. Because before the First Crusade, we have the beginnings of the Reconquista. There's incredibly important third theater of crusading that outlasts the Crusader states in Outremer. That's the Baltic. The Teutonic Knights, from the 1190s, take up, early 13th century, take up the sort of mantle of perpetual crusade against the pagans in the Baltic. I think that this goes back a little bit to why I call this book Crusaders as well. Defining the Crusades, numbering the Crusades, using the term the Crusades, arguing about what constitutes or does not constitute a crusade is such like a historian's parlor game. It's all us putting terminology onto events in the past. But it struck me like how to define a crusade actually in the Middle Ages was pretty simple. Anywhere you found crusaders, this was a crusade, because there's a word for crusader that's current in the Middle Ages, as you know, Crucis Ignati, someone who's been signed by the cross. Now, if you're a crusader, wherever you're fighting, by definition, we're talking about a crusade. So what on earth, or who on earth are we to say that, oh, no, only the guys sort of heading for Jerusalem, they're the only real crusaders. I'm sorry, if you're taking the crusade vow and you're beating up your neighbor with like a stick, and this, you know, all, I'm parodying slightly, by the time you get to the 14th, 15th century, that's pretty much all crusading has become, mm-hmm. particularly post-Innocent III, you know, turn of the 12th into 13th centuries, when Innocent really just takes the brakes off crusading, and anything he says is a crusade is a crusade. That's how you end up with the Fourth Crusade, burning and sacking Constantinople. That's how you end up with an Albigensian Crusade. That's how you end up with massive expansion of the Baltic Crusades. That's how, although that goes back, of course, to St. Bernard of Clairvaux, that's how you end up with crusading against Holy Roman Emperors. I mean, crusading against the Hohenstaufen, for goodness sake. This is the most insane thing, when you think about it, that you've ever heard, apart from crusading itself, killing in the name of Jesus Christ. So in some ways, maybe it's just that crusading is extended to its absurd end point, logically, because it's so absurd in the beginning. Sorry, I've digressed slightly from my point. I've wandered from my point. What I'm saying is crusading can only be understood in a pluralistic way. It makes no sense to ignore everything except the Holy Land. It literally doesn't make any sense because you're ignoring a whole bunch of people who were crusaders. Here comes my dog. Hold on one second. Hello, Prince. You're all wet. Oh, my God. He is soaking wet. So, oh no, you're too, you filthy, get off. Sorry.
I will edit this out.
Ask me something else. No, keep it in. It adds a little life.
There you go. Hi, Prince.
Oh, he's just shaking water all over a new painting I've just acquired. Bad dog. You can edit this bit out.
All right.
Pick up, quick.
Okay, so we're talking about crusades being everywhere, Baltic, and you actually end with the end of the Reconquista and Columbus, which I think actually is brilliant because a lot of that kind of motivation that fuels the crusades in Europe, Asia, it comes over on the ships with Columbus. And I thought that was kind of a nice place to end that. You were just talking not too long ago with George R.R. Martin about his stuff, and he was influenced in some way by what was going on in the Middle East, especially with the Mamluks as well, right? So what did you guys talk about when you talked about Mamluks?
What did George and I talk about when we talked about Mamluks? I can't remember now. That's a great time. Look, this is, you know, back in August, George came through London on his way to a fantasy convention in Dublin, and HarperCollins, his publishers here in the UK, asked if I would host this Q&A with him. And then they sent me a box of pretty much all his books. Now, I've read many of his books, but not all. And it was an unreadably vast amount of literature to try and cram before an audience, like, and we're doing this live thing in front of 1,000, what's going to be, best part of 1,000 people. I had anxiety dreams every single night before talking to George because, like, the depth of knowledge that I felt like I was going to have to know my Aegon the Conqueror from my Aegon the Unready. Just, it's already. Anyway, did we talk about the Mamluks? I can't remember if we talked about the Mamluks. I mean, the Mamluks clearly are sort of a major influence on the Unsullied, these ideas, but then so are the Spartans, right?
Yeah.
George's, as he said many times, George's kind of thing is to cherry pick the best bits from his vast historical reading, blend them together, file off the serial numbers, turn it all up to 11, put them in different clothes, and bang, off you go. I think the one thing that you get he's a very deep thinker about history. He consumes popular history voraciously. He's not much time for academic history. He loves the sort of Thomas Costain, you know, books about Plantagenets. I've set him straight on the best one to read about Plantagenets since.
Good.
But in all seriousness, he's a great reader of popular history. He loves the form. if you've read his latest book, Fire and Blood, The Targaryen History, he's also mastered the writing of the form, which I felt I was infuriated by. I'm like, how can you be this good at everything? Like, you just sort of toss off a masterpiece of popular history, structurally speaking, which is all completely invented and sort of has this depth of world building to it as well. He is just some sort of genius, and he's a great company, very funny, very sharp. He's great. He's just totally great, actually.
Yeah, you're totally a fanboy.
No, I was, you know, because I've gone all speechless. He's just a great writer. He's like, and I mean, without a capital, that I mean this, the capital G, he is a great writer. Mm-hmm. He's the best world builder since Tolkien. And he is, because of the success of the television show, you know, massively in demand all around the world. Can't like go anywhere without being. He went to the Tower of London when he was over here. Didn't tell them, just went in and like basically closed down the Tower of London because he was wandering around there like on his own or with a couple of friends. So this is like a mega star. And I was like mega starstruck. Like not in the way that I couldn't operate or have a conversation either on stage or off stage, but just like I'm very privileged, right? Hey, guess what? Says a white man. Like, no, I'm very a privileged person now. And so I'm quite blasé about things, or can be quite blasé about things that are extremely special if I just stopped once in a while and appreciated them. So it does take quite a big thing to knock me off my, like, knock me out of my lane. And spending like an evening talking to George R. R. Martin was definitely that big thing. And I was like, oh my God, dude, like, you're a god to me.
But you still took a moment to say, no, read my book about the Plantagenets, which I think is brilliant.
Okay. Oh, look, babe, I'm always selling.
Okay, I have to ask you a question about that. This is just for my personal interest. So you write these big sweeping histories like Plantagenets, Wars of the Roses, Crusaders, where things are going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And I don't know how you do it, because I get so frustrated by people who are fighting over the same patch of land that I cannot possibly spend time on it. What is it that brings you to these kind of sweeping times where people are fighting over this same area, this same spot, these same rights? What is it that brings you to those? Because you're coming back to them sort of again and again.
Yeah, I guess I am. It's not that conscious, actually. I just have I'm drawn to the okay, I'm going to have to bite the bullet. Who wants to sit on my lap? I'm drawn to the epic and to the big. I don't do subtlety especially well. I just like things to be big. I'm like, I realize I'm sounding like Donald Trump all of a sudden. You know? I read a brilliant piece about Trump the other day, which said he only knows about 100 words, and around a third of those refer to volume or size. And it made me laugh so much. Anyway, put that aside. Let's not get into that. I just like big story and big. I paint on a big canvas. That's where I'm like, that's my sort of attack phase, mode, place of writing. And so given that I've like wound up writing about the Middle Ages, these are just the stories that I come to. It's a bunch of people fighting over the same little spot. I mean, with regard to the Crusades, whether, you know, that's not exclusive to the Middle Ages. Yeah. Right. That term prisoners of geography applies in spades to, you know, Greater Syria, Mesopotamia, you know, Palestine, to give them their sort of older terms, Israel now, obviously, Lebanon. That's why the news is still full of Kurds and Syrians and Palestinians and, you know, and Egypt and Arabia and Iran. You know, this is nothing new, and it's geography as much as anything else. Yeah. That traps us there. So it's not exclusive to the Middle Ages, I suppose, what I'm saying.
So let's talk about that then. So you decided to write a book about Crusaders right at this moment, which could be pretty fraught. I mean, this is something.
No, I didn't decide to write it at this moment. I decided I agreed to write it. Let's be accurate here. I agreed to write it actually in 2014.
Yes, yes, I do remember that.
That was, it was part of a longer comp. This is the third book in a 3-book contract. But I take your point. I take your point, your broader point.
In Go on. The broader point being, post 9/11 world, you're writing about Crusaders. This is something that could be, you know, a tricky thing to write about. You take it on. Why did you want to write about this now in 2014?
Because it matters now. Because it matters now as much, if not more than ever, because it's live. If you should happen upon, and God help you if you do, but if you should stumble to the Daily Stormer, for example, any kind of that hate lit of the white supremacist / alt-right, what do you see? Deus Fult, picture of a Knight Templar waving a sword. The number of crusades tropes and memes that you'll come across online, all directly drawing on crusading language, symbolism, and a distorted vision of what crusading was, which is to read it as a binary world war between Muslims and white Christian people, a zero-sum game in which one is must triumph. This is live at the moment. By the same token, any ISIS, Al-Qaeda adjunct terrorist attack, what will they usually say when they claim responsibility? We struck against citizens of the Crusader Coalition. You mentioned 9/11, of course, George W. Bush on 16th of September 2001, standing on the White House lawn saying this crusade, this war against terrorism is going to take a while. Whether he misspoke or did not misspeak, you know, he played directly into Al-Qaeda propaganda at the time, which going back at least to 98 and probably before, had been talking about making war on Jews and crusaders. So all of this is live. Like, I was in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday this year, when all those hotels and churches were bombed. I was supposed to be going to the Shangri-La the 24 hours after it got blown up. If 24 hours difference, I'd be sitting in the breakfast room with my kids, probably dead. And what did they say? We successfully attacked citizens of the Crusader Coalition celebrating their infidel holiday. Okay, so the point is, why write about it now? You've got to run towards it, man. Like, the worst thing to do would be not to write about it now. This really matters because people are taking this history and turning it into like a shit soup of fucking hate. Sorry.
No, I think that's fair.
And it's disgusting and it's wrong. And it's incumbent on historians, like, this is not new news to the medieval history community, of course. Like, I'm preaching back to the, you know, everyone what we already know, but let's reiterate, it is incumbent on medievalists as a group of people to say this was not, right, firstly, the Crusades is not some sort of civilizational binary struggle to the death, zero sum, between Christians and Muslims, full stop. That's just nonsense. Secondly, do you want to go back to a crusading period? No, of course not. I've just written an entire book in which every chapter is about a bunch of people slaughtering each other, different groups of people slaughtering each other for different, slightly different reasons in slightly different places. But nevertheless, the dominant theme is heads coming off.
Yeah.
Are we comfortable with people bandying around the word crusade, not only in a sort of the alt-right and ISIS way, but even, you know, I get this Google alert for the crusades coming to my phone every day, like at 5:30, about tea time it comes through. And every day there's another raft of news headlines in which the word crusade is sort of sloppily used. So there's one the other day that said, Joe Biden is on a crack house crusade. I'm like, what is a crack house crusade? And is Biden shutting crack houses down here, or like, does he want some crack? Like, I don't know. It depends which news network you're probably getting it from as to what the story would or would not say. That's just one example among many. You know, even the president of the United States went there. He called, I think he said the Dems were on a crusade against him. I mean, shit, but he's been talking about being lynched as well. So let's not take much notice of what comes out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But like, here's the point I'm driving at is we overuse and misuse and over misuse the word crusade right now when actually it's killing people.
Yeah,
people are dying because people are misusing misappropriating crusading history, and so we need to be talking about it,
yeah,
writing about it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you did. And I think that you have a voice that people will hear. And I like that you took it and made it as complicated as it was, because this ostensibly is a crusade, is about religious difference, but that is way too simplistic a look at it. And so you get at how it's complicated by different motivations for people going out there, right? Like, if you went out there, then people couldn't sue you and they can charge you interest on your loans. Like, there's a lot of reasons to go out there. And so when you were complicating the reasons for people going to become crusaders, did you keep in mind that this was kind of your driving point to make sure that this wasn't being seen in a binary way, so that when people read this book, they would see it as more complicated?
No, that's not what was in my mind while I was writing it. I read a funny review on Amazon the other day that just said, I haven't read this book, but this writer has some sort of disgusting radical leftist agenda. My God, that's insane. You don't know me at all. No, well, so I don't have a disgusting radical leftist agenda, number one. And no. So look, I set aside thoughts about modern politics during the writing phase. The writing phase is writing narrative history. Mm. The complexity is there because it needs to be complex, because it was complex. That's just good history. It's saying this is what happened, and look, it's not that straightforward. But that's in and of itself, that's just historical good practice, I think. Like, the linking it to modern politics in a sort of purposeful way, that comes sort of before and after, but it's not that's not how the book is written, and it's not a sort of crypto political statement. It's a work of history yes, first and foremost.
Yeah.
That I would argue has resonance and even relevance if you want to think about the world today. But you're by no means compelled to think about the world today while you read it. You know, this is a book that it should and does stand on its own as a work of popular history. And if you want to think more deeply about how that pertains to our present day situations, then I'll be glad. But, you know, there's no, you don't have to.
That's right. Just read it, enjoy it. But it's going to be really difficult
to fun,
not.
Right? Have fun.
Yeah.
Have fun.
Yeah.
Read it. Have fun. That's cool. Okay, that's cool.
That
like
is...
it's like watching one of those goddamn Marvel movies my kids like so much. You watch some of them and you go, okay, I think there's some sort of like didactic purpose hidden beneath this, but my kids don't give a flying monkeys whatever.
Whatever.
Like, they just think it's like Spider-Man's awesome.
Yeah, but I mean, that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, Spider-Man's awesome. He might also teach you something. Your book is awesome. It might also make people think differently about
the
Crusades.
The key is might. It might.
Yes.
It might do. It might not. But have a good time. Enjoy it, man. That's like, I wrote it for fun. I had fun writing it. And ultimately, God, life is too damn tenuous for a lot of people at the moment to go around with everything being serious, right? I can't even open social media someday, because it's just like, particularly Twitter, I'm just like, this is like just walking into a bar fight in which everyone is like mad. And we do need to pause and have a little bit of enjoyment as well. And so I do try and write with a certain sort of joie de vivre, so that if you just want to switch off and read a chapter about the Fourth Crusade, then like, sick as those Venetians were, it'll still be a rollickingly exciting 25 minutes of your life.
I think we're going to leave it there. That's the perfect spot. Yes. Thank you. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah. No, pleasure.
To find out more about Dan's work, you can follow him on Facebook at Dan Jones Historian or Twitter at DG Jones. Crusaders is available now in the United Kingdom and United States, although Canadians will have to wait until spring. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, I guess we have to start off with some sad news. There was a medieval castle in Okinawa called Shuri Castle, which unfortunately had a major fire last week and pretty much burned to the ground. So this was a castle that's originally 600 years old and has been destroyed and rebuilt many times over the centuries. But again, it's a very sad loss. So we have some news on that. We also have a new series that starts from Steven Mulberger, and it's called Tales from the Hundred Years' War. So he's going to be talking about some of the smaller, lesser-known episodes that happened during that conflict. And his first one is called The Duel at La Roche-Saint-Doire. So you can read about that. And if you really want to know more about the Hundred Years' War, well, there was The King on Netflix. And you have your own review of that mighty film about Henry V and Agincourt. And that's online. And what quick review from you. Should we watch it?
Yes. You should watch it with all the normal caveats for watching a medieval film, which is don't expect it to be super accurate, but just sit back and let yourself be entertained.
Woohoo! All right. Sounds like fun.
Okay. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
If you're new to the podcast, why not check out our Patreon page where we have some great deals, including subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, a book club in partnership with Boydell and Brewer, and even a $3 level where you can access the desktop version of medievalist.net ad-free. You can find it all at patreon.com/medievalists. When I finished my own new book earlier this year, I sent Dan Jones a copy to get his take on it. He called it a very human history, sometimes weird, always wonderful. I still need to get that last bit printed on a t-shirt, but in the meantime, if you want to see what Dan was on about, my book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, is available now in the United Kingdom, coming to Canada in December, and the United States in January. You can find it on Amazon or at Pen and Sword. Massive thanks to everyone who's bought a copy already. I really hope you love it. To keep up with all the news in the medieval world, you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can find me on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you, as always, for lending me your ears this week. Have yourself an awesome day.